We're going to open our meeting on the Senate Education Interim Committee, and the first order of business is to adopt the interim committee rules. This is the first meeting since we've had the interim, and so we're going to open a work session organizational meeting to adopt the committee rules, and I'll take a motion from my co-chair, because these are the same rules we've had in the past.
You bet. Chair Roblin, I would move to adopt the interim committee rules dated September 20th of 2017.
Our outstanding senator from the eastern part of southern Oregon has made the motion to adopt the interim committee rules dated September 20th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? They are adopted. We'll close our organizational meeting, and we will start a... we were going to have... that's right. I can do it right now. So I'm going to form, as many people know, we had a lot of conversations about cultural competency, and there's a program that we've had up in the Portland area that Karanja Cruz has been working with. And so I had some great meetings in the interim, and I'm going to assign a work group to our good Senator Gelser. And you can figure, if there's other people who would like to be on that, they should get a hold of Senator Gelser or Lisa and let us know. But we're going to have them work on a work group to look at stuff for this term and the following session to see where we go with that. So thank you, Senator Gelser, for having had the conversations and for being willing to lead that work group. And with that, we're going to open an informational hearing on higher education data collection. With that, we'll invite our good guests, Amy Cox, to the table, and thank you for being here.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin, Senators. My name is Amy Cox. For the record, I am the director of the Office of Research and Data at Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I'm here to talk with you today about the kinds of data we have and use it at the HEC. I appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion and hope it will be informative for you. Today's presentation, where am I aiming this? Perhaps it's not on.
Here we go. There we go.
Thank you. Today's presentation is structured in a three-part format. First, I'll speak about the kinds of collections that we have and a bit about how we process those. Then several slides on the use that we make of those data, the reporting, research and policy analysis, and public information purposes that we serve. And then finally, close the discussion with a slide about the gaps, the kinds of data that we do not have at the HEC. The HEC compiles many sources of data into one agency, the bulk of which are student-level records. These include both student academic records from our public universities and community colleges, and to a lesser extent our private schools, student financial records, primarily as the result of their applications for federal or state student assistance. Some supplemental submissions, primarily in response to legislative report requirements, and also some workforce data that come into our Office of Workforce Investments. The student academic records come to us, as I said, they're collected by our higher education institutions, and we receive copies of those data, primarily from our 7 public universities and 17 community colleges. This past year, we began a collection of student records, academic records from our private schools, accepting those in the Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. That data collection is still certainly in development, but it has been an exciting addition to our public institutions, and Oregon really is leading the effort in that collection. The content of these records includes a host of student characteristics, including things like residency, age, race, ethnicity, gender, as well as academic records, their enrollment status, their number of credits earned or attempted, and of course completions, both certificate and degree completions. Our student financial records come, as I said, primarily as applications for federal aid. The free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, that many of you may be familiar with, is an application that serves both to receive federal student aid as well as Oregon student programs. Those application records come to the HEC, into our Eugene office, from the federal government, and are supplemented by the ORSA application for students who are not eligible for federal student aid. We also have a number of private scholarships that the agency administers, and those application records are also in our student database. The content of those records is similar to the academic records in the sense that it has information about students, their characteristics, but of course also it includes information about financial characteristics, their family financial status, as well as the size of and type of any financial aid that they would receive. This includes, of course, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as well as the Oregon Promise and the federal Pell Grant. Those are the three main sources of aid. The supplemental submissions that we receive come from particular legislative bills. We receive a set of summary financial information from our community colleges that are posted on our website, as well as some summary information about the kinds of positions, generally management or supervisory or academic, at our public institutions. And then, as I said, we also receive workforce data that focuses on both workforce programs and information about them, as well as on the participants in those programs. Those serve the purpose of being able primarily to track the progress and the outcomes of students who are in those programs, a lot of which satisfies federal reporting requirements for federal grant dollars. The receipt of these different data collections involves substantial staff resources. It includes processes involved in working with the institutions to receive the data, as well as cleaning, making sure that the data are consistent, and then a host of staff who work on analyzing those data for multiple different purposes. We are in the midst of also planning some additional data warehouse processes and system in our agency. That's a bit of a longer term effort, but we'll be able to pool these different sources of data in ways that will make the analysis of them more efficient, and also provide some foundational work for longer term efforts to try and to enable public interaction with the data. These data are stored on the state's servers in the Enterprise Technology Services at DAS, so they have the same degree of security across the board, and is consistent with other Oregon confidential data sources. We receive these data under authority from state statute. The one that puts the HEC into existence, that enables us to receive the students' academic records to further state goals in higher education, to be able to track progress toward those goals, identify what those goals need to be. And then, of course, for the private schools, under the statute that governs HEC's authority to regulate the private institutions. Beyond the receipt of the data, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act of 1974 protects our use of the data and restricts our the degree to which we both use and release those data, because they do, of course, include students' confidential information, namely their identifying information. That FERPA Act restricts our use to reporting and research purposes. I want to talk next about the use that we make of these data, which falls into basically three different areas: reporting requirements, which include both federal and state reporting requirements, as well as supplementary reporting that we provide to institutions and individual organizations. Number two, research and policy analysis, which we use to evaluate and inform higher education policies and programs. I think that is the area where we're seeing the most promise and have the most excitement about using these data. I'll get to that in a few minutes, as well as information for the public. The HEC produces over 30 federal reports each year and over 150 financial reports to the federal government. Many of these fall into grants received for workforce and educational programs, the Carl T. Perkins Grant, which focuses on career and technical education, and the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which focuses on workforce programs. Those grant monies and others come into the agency and flow to other programs, and we track the progress of students and participants of those programs to report back to the federal government. On the state side, the HEC completes 36 state reporting tasks each year, this first slide of which shows those related to the to legislative statutes that include a reporting requirement. Most of these come back to you all, as well as some to the governor. And in addition, we have a number of other reports that are that serve state requirements. Some of them, such as the annual key performance measures, our agency KPMs that we're in the midst of right now that will come to the legislature, or our submission to the state longitudinal data system that you'll hear about a little later this afternoon. And then, in addition, usually in parallel with these other reporting requirements, we provide information to the institutions. This is some of that information to help them track their own progress in both those grant dollars as well as in program work. And then finally, we submit data reports to a number of independent organizations to be engaged in the national conversation and efforts to strengthen higher education. These are organizations with whom we work regularly, both to identify how Oregon is succeeding or has room to grow, especially compared to our near neighbors. I said earlier that the policy analysis and research that we're engaging in our office is some of the most exciting areas that we're using the data, and this slide speaks to that. We have a number of efforts underway that I wanted to highlight for you. Currently, some deeper analysis in terms of two bills passed this past spring, summer in the legislative session. The bill, House Bill 2998, that focuses on community college to public university transfer. We're looking at the courses taken, the credits received, the majors to help enable that discussion among the faculty at the universities and the community colleges, as well as House Bill 2311 that focuses on our 40-40-20 Guiding Star to focus that on high school graduating cohorts and identify other attainment goals for other adults. We also have a number of assessments that we are putting together in our office to help track and progress in higher education in this state and identify areas where we might be able to push that progress further, faster. Those include a higher education dashboard that we are working with our commission to be able to track progress, as well as state and institutional profiles. These are profiles of student progress, of enrollment, affordability at both the state and the institution level. These will be hopefully rolling out later this fall for our community colleges and public universities. And then finally, some county-level profiles that show the educational progress and status and the socioeconomic context at the counties in our state. And I think that I want to return for a second with regard to that, to House Bill 2311 and the other attainment goals, because I think it provides an extraordinary opportunity to engage local communities in higher education and higher education goals as that discussion moves forward. And the county level profiles will are designed to be able to further that discussion. And then lastly, in the red box, the HEC also collaborates with multiple different partners in doing some additional kinds of policy research, especially that for which our own internal capacity is limited. And that includes programs, research programs, and research projects looking at the Oregon Promise, which has gained substantial attention, at community college career pathways, at accelerated learning in its variety of forms in the state, and also most recently at the community college to university transfer question. We also produce a number of analyses for the general public. We have summary graphs and tables about student enrollment and completions on our website and a searchable community college database for basic tabulations of community college information, those financial reports that I mentioned earlier, as well as a monthly external newsletter that has a featured data and report section so that folks who are reading our monthly external newsletter can see some recent data analyses as well as finally ongoing media and other information requests, which we field in the agency, those that come into our office in the Office of Research and Data that we respond to probably approximate a little over one a week. Lastly, I wanted to have an opportunity to share with you some of the kinds of information we do not have in our agency. And this is to serve a couple purposes. One is to clarify for you the kinds of questions that we simply are not able to answer, and another to identify areas for you where we're trying to expand our data collection, and then also, of course, just sort of what our hopes and dreams might be. I will tell you, more concrete than hopes and dreams is what's in the first, the green arrow, and that is, you know, we have a host of higher education data in our agency, as I've described, and we can identify students and how they're doing in higher education institutions in this state. We have quite a good ability to track them from community college to community college or from university to university. We have a less effective but still somewhat effective ability to track them from community college to university. What we really lack is the ability to be able to track them before they enter higher education and then after they leave. And so those connections to our primary pipelines of students, both K-12 and returning adults who are entering and exiting higher education from the K-12 system and into and out of employment, is much more limited. And that is really where the state longitudinal data system, that gap is where the state longitudinal data system will come to play, and we're very much looking forward to the work that they are producing so that we can answer questions like, you know, which students are not enrolling in college and which students, you know, what happened to the, you know, students that you know, had a certain set of characteristics in, say, eighth grade? Are they the ones who, like, how can we help them get through higher education once they get there? The brown arrow in the middle of the slide here shows some individual content areas that we lack in terms of our student information. And those include things like transcript data for entering students. So while we know the number of credits, for example, that a community college student entering a public university has from the university's perspective, we know how many if a transfer student arrives on a university campus and the university says, you know, you are coming in with 30 credits and you're good to go, what we don't know is whether that student also had another 10 credits or 5 credits that the university didn't accept. That's really transcript level data. Institutional grant aid. Our institutional partners, especially our public universities, provide quite a lot of tuition and fee remission and other forms of institutional grant aid to their incoming students that we don't have that information, although we seek to be working with them at least for some summary counts there, because I think it is key to being able to better assess affordability as well as to acknowledge the efforts of our institutional partners to make college more affordable. Accelerated learning, our data gap there really is following the development of the field. So the field of accelerated learning continues to incorporate different kinds of accelerated learning programs, and most of those are in our data collections, but things like like direct enrollment or kinds of accelerated learning that are not part of a more official program are not included. As that field continues to evolve, we will continue to incorporate more kinds of measures. This next bullet, the identification of high school graduates and degree-seeking students at community colleges, is really a key missing piece for us to be able to accurately assess completion at the community colleges. So we know which students have completed a certificate or an associate degree. What we don't have as good a handle on as we would like is which of the students were seeking that to begin with. And the reason for that is really multitude, but certainly a driver is the fact that our community colleges have a very broad mission to include, to open access to as many students as possible, to include as many kinds of students who may not initially be imagining they would receive an associate degree, but getting them in the door. So that broad mission, you know, combined with their educational mission means that, you know, we don't always have a way to define those students who are degree seeking as well as we really would like to, and as easily as we can at the public universities, you know, where students enroll expecting to get a bachelor's degree. Race ethnicity, we have, you know, a finite set of racial ethnic options that are very useful for tracking a lot of equity related indicators. They are, like many racial ethnic options, you know, finite. They are limited. So they just prevent us from being able to do deeper dives into looking at variations within groups, especially if you think about, for example, biracial groups or Asian Americans, you know, among whom there's quite a wide range of different kinds of challenges. Student loan information. We have federal student loan information for students who file a FAFSA and are enrolled at a public university, but we have no information on private student loans. And that, of course, is a huge affordability challenge for our students. Unfortunately, there's not a location for those data, so I can't ask you to do a particular take a particular action that would provide those data, but rather they're not going to be available to a state agency in a way in the foreseeable future, at least. And then our private school data development, as I said, is still in its new stages and growing as we move forward. We also do not have information about faculty and staff at our public institutions or private. Just that is a difference from some of the agencies that preceded the HEC or organizations. And also institution budget and expenditure data. We have summary accounts of some of that information provided by our institutions. We don't have detailed information. So those questions around that are questions that we are not able to answer. And with that, I will conclude these slides and invite your questions.
So, any questions? I guess I have just a couple, and Kyle can ask, be a part of that one too, so I'll invite Kyle up. We do need to look, from my perspective, at some of the gaps and the ones that are the most important. So I would hope that HEC would start thinking about what would be the best information for us to have so that we can decide as a group whether we want to institutionalize that by putting statutes that give you the authority to get the kinds of things you have. One such one, and you've already responded with Senator Dembro, had to do with 113 and whether or not we have different reporting dates and a couple other things that need to be addressed, and you didn't have the time to get those introduced into as bills. We do have a committee bill that I think may be available, so I'm asking you to think about what it is that we need to do to finish up the 113 issue with regard to what kind of data and what kind of legislative authority you need to have to do that one, along with how to align a reporting date so you don't have multiple reporting dates, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. So if you can work with Lisa about that, we'll see if we have one. Right now we have one other bill that we're looking at on for a committee bill that has to do with when we changed the law last year to allow teachers to get their to not have to have their certificate if all the information was in. We didn't do that for administrators and others, and so there was a gap that created a problem. And I think we're getting a bill that will work on that one to fix that bill that we took. So if we can get the information from you with Lisa, we'll see if we can get an answer to 113 so you can actually do the work and have the authority to do that.
Senator Roveland, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the HEC. If I could just quickly respond to that. The good thing about Senate Bill 113 was that it was a work group that produced right. recommendations along this front, and so we can, dust those off. They were submitted, I believe, in December 2016, which was a little late for the governor's policy development process, and we had transitions internally, and so I think it just got put to the side. But we can certainly bring those recommendations to you. Okay. I would think they're no less valid today than they were last December.
And we'd like to look at that now. And this is first Lisa heard about it, too, but I've been talking with Senator Dembro, and I think that would be helpful. At least then we can decide if that's something we want to put in or not as one of our committee bills. And to me, it meets the requirements that we're trying to do with these short sessions, which is fix things that we didn't finish up in the past as opposed to all new ideas. So thank you for that. And thank you for that. And thanks for pointing out, because later we're going to hear from the longitudinal data system, where the gaps that you pointed them out, which was really nice, about how to do that longitudinal stuff. And I hope as we get into this that we can actually have more of those filled in so that good research and questions can be asked that can help us do a better job of policy. So any other questions or thoughts for this group? Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And have a great day.
Thank you.
And Lisa will be waiting for you. So we'll close our informational hearing on higher education data collection. We'll open an informational hearing on an update on ESSA, and we'll have Salam Noor, our Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, and whoever he wants with him. This is the email from Denver.
Okay.
I just got
there. You do.
I thought I'd ask this earlier. She's working.
All right.
She'll have it here shortly.
Okay. So, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction with the Oregon Department of Education. And to my right is?
Emily Nassara, Legislative Coordinator with the Oregon Department of Education.
We appreciate the opportunity to provide you an update on the Oregon Plan for the Every Student Succeeds Act. We presented to you in the past on our progress and development of the plan, and today I'm going to give you an update on the work up to this point. First of all, I want to say that we are thrilled to inform you, you probably know that by now, that our plan was approved by the U.S. Department of Education. Yeah. We're in the first round of states. I think there are 10 states that have been approved, and we are delighted that our plan was accepted as is. There were some minor technical adjustments that we needed to make in the form of clarifications, but there wasn't any substantive feedback that we received from the U.S. Department of Education, and they were actually complementary to the plan, its depth and breadth, comprehensiveness, the public engagement process that led to the development of the plan, and the ambitious goals that we have for both achievement and graduation. So we are happy about that. This is the timeline that we operated under. Submitted the plan on May 3rd, received feedback on June 30th. We had 2 weeks to turn it around, did that, and we were approved on August 30th of 2017. Just by way of a quick background, the Every Student Succeeds Act is a reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. We all know it as No Child Left Behind of 2002. It was revised in 2012 under a waiver flexibility provision by the U.S. Department of Education, and then signed into law by the President in December of 2015. We've shared this information with you before, but I want to underscore the equity aspect of this plan. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act is a civil rights law. It was actually born out of the civil rights movement in the United States, and it's intended to support students that have been historically underserved by the education system in the states. So we use those resources to supplement the educational experiences and opportunities that we provide to our students. We were really excited this year to see three important words in the law, and that is well-rounded education. And that is a promise that we believe that we need to act on and implement programs that afford students a well-rounded education. There are four key areas of flexibility that were provided to us, and we took advantage of those, and I'll share with you some of the developments that are occurring in each one of those. But one in the area of assessment, high school assessment specifically, where it allows us to use something other than SBAC at the high school level, the Smarter Balance Assessment, such as ACT, SAT, and perhaps any other nationally norm reference assessments, the accountability framework relative to reporting on school performance, student and school performance, school improvement, and that's the methodology that we use for identifying schools that are in need of improvement, and the educator effectiveness provision. With this flexibility, there's still retained accountability, and it just strikes a much better balance between flexibility and accountability. Our plan is a consolidated state plan that identifies the strategies that we're going to use as a state to support students in these programs, starting with Title I-A. And the opportunity that we have under the flexibility provision is to actually blend these funding sources. In the past, we had to treat them separately. On many occasions, we actually supported the same student out of multiple funding sources, but we were not able to blend or braid those funds. The flexibility that we're encouraging schools and districts to take advantage of is actually the blending of general funds and federal funds, which was not available prior to ESSA. So our plan is really based on four key commitments or pillars, if you will. And those were gleaned from a very extensive process of public engagement, nearly 24 community forums throughout the state of Oregon, where we engaged with educators, community members, board members, general public, colleges, universities, communities of color, and many diverse communities around the state, including rural communities. So the four key commitments are prioritize and advance equity. As I indicated earlier, that this is a civil rights law, but what that really means is actively initiating and leading conversations about equity, sharing and using data to identify disparities, being culturally responsive, proactively seeking support from parents, families, communities to meet the needs of each and every student in our system. The promise of a well-rounded education really is predicated on this notion that we want to support rich learning environments in which all students can thrive, and a safe learning environment and supports they need to be successful. Fairly common criticism of No Child Left Behind is that the curriculum has narrowed. There's an overemphasis on English language arts and math, reading specifically, in fact, for the purpose of accountability. So we're trying to use this as an opportunity to engage with schools and districts and communities around the state and say, let's look at education. In fact, when we launched our community forums, we didn't approach it strictly from a plan development aspect. We said, let's reimagine education in the state of Oregon. What do we want students to know and be able to do? How does local context become relevant to that process? And that takes me to the ongoing engagement piece. One of the things that resulted from No Child Left Behind is really limiting the dialogue or the conversations between districts and communities, and even districts and parents, I would say, simply because it was a prescribed formula. You followed that recipe. If you didn't do it right, there were consequences. If you did it right, there were rewards. And it wasn't really a very productive system, if you will. So districts have to submit new plans to us, and those plans will be based on the priorities that districts want to use to achieve the outcomes that we've outlined in the plan, which is improvement on the academic areas, growth for English language learners, as well as achievement on the academic areas and graduation. And we're encouraging them to engage parents, communities, and stakeholders in that process. So the plan should not be developed exclusively by the district and submitted to us. We want them to engage in a process that involves a needs assessment, a reflection on their practices, a reflection on their results, and the strategies that they're using to get there. So the ongoing engagement is a real key component here. And the last one I will mention is strengthening district systems, and this is a huge shift from the way we've engaged with schools and districts in the past, especially relative to improvement. In the past, under the waiver and No Child Left Behind, the interactions were between the state and the school. The district was not always involved in that conversation and the work that the school did. So under the system, our partnership will be with districts, because districts are ultimately responsible for the improvement of their schools and their students. And the intention here is to build capacity at the district level, and whatever innovations or enhancements or practices that are being implemented at that particular school that's receiving that support could actually be learned and distributed to the other schools in the district. So this is a new direction that we're moving in, where we're supporting districts, we're partnering with districts to develop systems that are sustainable and to develop practices that can be shared with other schools in that district. In a nutshell, these three areas are the key levers in our Oregon plan for the Every Student Succeeds Act. And I've touched on some of those, but very quickly, let me just share with you some highlights here. The report card redesign is a key policy lever, we believe, because the report card is going to be inclusive of other categories than just academic achievement. And we're excited about that, because it's going to provide more information to parents at a very high level, and yet still provide very detailed data on student performance disaggregated by student group. So the goal here is to develop a report card that is in a dashboard format. Right now we have a summative score, if you will. We have a summative score that we assign to a school from 1 to 5 based on student performance. And if you're a 1, then you're in need of improvement. If you're a 5, you're an exceptional school. And we're trying to expand that interaction between schools and communities by including additional information. So we will not have a summative score moving forward. However, we will have a dashboard that contains a lot of information, and we will be able to provide an assessment of where that school and district are relative to that category. So some of the indicators that we're looking at are chronic absenteeism, English language arts and math achievement, English language arts and math growth, English language progress, and English language on track using our ELPA assessment tool, 9th grade on track, 4-year and 5-year graduation rates, and 5-year completer rates. So this will provide a much more comprehensive look, and we will begin to identify multiple indicators of student and school success instead of relying exclusively on state testing. You could go back, please. Yeah. I'll share with you some information about the timeline that we're under right now. The balanced assessment system is taking advantage of the flexibility that's afforded to us under the Every Student Succeeds Act, especially at the high school level. So we initiated a process that's called Request for Information, and we did receive information from two vendors, ACT and College Board. College Board administers the SAT, and we're going to use that information to develop an RFP that will potentially lead to a new high school assessment that will be implemented in the spring of 2019. And we presented this information to the Ways and Means Committee on Education and indicated to them that there is an added cost associated with this. Be happy to discuss that with you. However, we also made some additional changes to the assessment based on feedback that we gathered from the field relative to the length of the assessment, the appropriateness of the assessment, the time it takes for students to take the test, and the preparation associated with that. So starting this year, in the spring of 18, students will see a shorter assessment, and I will tell you that the field is absolutely thrilled about that. And we did that without compromising the integrity of the assessment, the fidelity of the assessment, or the quality of the assessment. We're just reducing the amount of time by reducing the footprint of the assessment. So we will do that this year, and we'll go through the RFP process and hopefully have a test identified by spring of 2018 to administer in the spring of 2019. And the science assessment is also on track to be implemented. On the school improvement side, I touched on this. What I want to touch on just very briefly are the new categories that we will be using to identify schools for improvement. Currently, we call those focus and priority schools. Moving forward, we will call them comprehensive support schools and targeted support schools. And we will use the categories I mentioned earlier in the report card to identify those schools. So a comprehensive support school essentially is a Title I school, and it could be an elementary, middle, or high school. And if and they're typically the bottom 10% of performance, which we call level one, for at least half of the indicators for all students. So if all students don't meet those indicators, then that school potentially is identified as a comprehensive support school, but they have to be a Title I school, except for high schools. If a high school has a graduation rate of 67% or less, then they're automatically in that category, and they're eligible to receive support and targeted partnerships from the U.S. from us, the Oregon Department of Education. The targeted support schools are also in the bottom 10% category for at least half of the indicators for a specific student group. So a school and the targeted schools are any school. They don't have to be a Title I school. And the intention here is to identify persistence, low performance with particular groups of students in that school, and to engage the district in looking at that to truly determine if they need to be in that category or not. So we're shifting from a compliance, strictly compliance regulatory model to one where we're partnering, we're asking questions, we're getting information from districts, seeking clarifications, and most importantly, using the data that we have to inform the decisions and the work that we do. The other thing that I will mention is that we're affording districts some flexibility relative to the development of those plans. We talked to many superintendents in the state, and many of them tell me, we have two plans, the one we sent to you and the one that we keep and use regularly and on a daily basis here in the district. So we're trying to eliminate the need for two plans, and we're affording districts flexibility on the tools that they can use to develop those plans to submit to us. We will provide guidance, we will provide direction, we will provide categories that they need to respond to show us strategies for improvement, but we're not going to require them all to use the same tool, and that's the flexibility that we're working with them on. So that's the substantive aspect of the presentation. I'd like to share with you just a timeline of where we are today and where we're headed. So we started the stakeholder engagement process with parents and communities around the state, and that is with communities of color, diverse communities, rural, urban communities. And we're talking to parents, and we're asking them, what do you want to see on this report card? How much information do you need? And that led us to the development of this two-tiered system. One is at a glance, which it could be a couple, two, three pages, but it will have pertinent information about that school and the district. And then the online dashboard will provide a lot more details that a parent or a policymaker or a legislator or somebody like us would be interested in diving a little bit deeper and taking a look at that data in a more disaggregated form. And again, the idea is to not have a summative score, but information that can lead to engagement on the part of the parents with the school relative to what's happening in that school, and information that schools and parents can use to get involved and participate in school improvement activities. On the high school's test side, I indicated that we released an RF request for information. We should be releasing a request for proposal this winter. Spring 2018, we will continue the build-out of the report card, and by then hopefully identify a test that we could implement in the spring of 19. In the summer of 2018, we will formally identify comprehensive support and targeted support schools, and we will start working with those schools on the development of their plans based on the guidance that we provided. And again, this is a partnership between us and the district, and we're helping the district help their schools. And we will start the planning process for the high school test in 19. This is what the report card potentially will look like. These are the accountability indicators I mentioned earlier. You see that some apply specifically to elementary and middle, and some are just high school. In addition to these categories on the report card, we're going to have a section that says well-rounded education, and that's an opportunity for schools and districts to identify practices, programs, opportunities, things that they want to share with their community that are in the area of well-rounded education. And we're not leaving that completely abstract. We defined what well-rounded education is. We provided some examples, and we will continue to provide resources and tools and suggestions for districts to use in that category. Fall of 2018, the new report card will be released, and the dashboard will be in place, and then we will do the formal identification of comprehensive and targeted support schools. We're taking our time in fully and officially identifying those schools, because we want to have some engagement with districts relative to the data to make sure it's accurate, to make sure it's truly representative of what we think is happening in that school. So this is our implementation plan, and this is the timeline that we're on. Thank you, and I welcome any questions or comments or suggestions you may have.
Any questions from the group? I have a few. So going back to the targeted schools and, yes, and so on, and you were saying if they have subgroups that are not meeting pertinent requirements. The report card doesn't show the subgroups like the old report cards do. So are we going to still have all the same subgroups that we looked at before, and they will be highlighted and taken out in each individual subgroup across those different categories?
Yep. Chair Roblin, the intent is to continue to provide disaggregated data by subgroups, and in fact, we're looking to identify potentially new subgroups that we have concentrations of in our schools and districts around the state. So we will not move away from disaggregated data. We just want to put it in a format that is a lot more user-friendly and accessible, if you will.
So to be a subgroup, is the N still going to be about the same? Because it was a fairly small number.
Yes.
As you look at that to try to work with schools, if you had a bunch of subgroups that were very small and they didn't meet that range, you could have a very few group of kids identifying a whole school as a problem when, in fact, they need to maybe focus in on some of that. But a whole plan based on a small number would not necessarily be helpful. So I just wanted to...
Yep. Senator Roblin, you're absolutely right. I'm trying to remember the N size. I want to say it's probably 20.
Yeah, it was either 10 or 20. So
yeah, I think it's 20. And we tried to strike a balance so you don't actually lose track of a particular group of students at that school.
With that.
But we're also... going to do is, as we look at these subgroups, we're looking at the overall school performance, and then we're going to look at the indicators individually.
Okay.
So a student group may be not attending school. They may actually be absent, but they may be performing well. So we will engage with the district in a conversation to determine ultimately if that school falls into that category or not. Otherwise, quite honestly, we run the risk of identifying every school in the state of Oregon, just like we did with AYP, annual adequate yearly progress. And we don't want to do that. So we're trying to be very thoughtful and very methodical in engaging districts in conversations before we actually identify schools.
Okay, that's important. Number two, we did put out we haven't done the RFP yet, but we're starting to decide on the high school other alternative assessment. Are we making one of the criteria that they have to have show the alignment between Smarter Balance and the others as part of a basic requirement, let alone the RFP? Because I certainly wouldn't want a new test that doesn't have any relationship to our previous testing to align for kids.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
alignment
Senator
is important.
Senator Roblin, you're absolutely right. Whoever we select has to meet the requirements that are clearly stipulated in the Every Student Succeeds Act for this assessment. So it has to be aligned to the Common Core State Standards. It has to meet all of the accommodations, expectations, and requirements, especially for special education, English learners, and it has to meet the cultural bias test. And it has to go through peer review at the national level. So there is still a process that we have to go through with the U.S. Department of Education to guarantee that this assessment is the best assessment available for our students.
Okay. That was an important one for me.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, if we're going to keep testing them at a certain thing, then
right.
all of a sudden they get a new test that doesn't align to the same kind of standards. It's not very fair to the kids trying to take the test.
Absolutely.
The
yep.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
In terms of the following up with Senator Rowland, in terms of the CSI and TSI and the conversation that gets created there, what's the funding mechanism or support stream aside from your some series of, you've called them conversations. I don't know what that what that looks like and how that gets funded.
Yep. Chair Roblin, Senator Lithicum, the funding mechanism is through the school improvement process using the federal funds that we get under ESSA. So we've set aside some resources that we will provide specifically to schools that are identified under the CSI category for sure. We may not have enough resources to cover all of the targeted school category, but we will use the federal funds to support those schools, and we're still developing the methodology for that. In the past, we provided coaches, we provided small grants for them to develop specific plans relative to a key area that they needed to improve in, but the key mechanism is really utilizing the federal funds, and then the state and then the school district will use state funds to supplement. And now we have the opportunity to blend those funds where we were not able to in the past.
So. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. And I was pleased to see that the plan was approved and moving forward fairly quickly this time. We were in the second group, I think, last time
yes.
we were trying. So
yep.
it was nice to see that. So
great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. So we'll close our informational hearing on our update on ESSA, and we will open an informational hearing on the longitudinal database. So we'll have Colt Gill and John Starr come on up. And
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colt Gill, the Education Innovation Officer from the Chief Education Office. Thank you for your time on this topic today. I'm going to say we're pretty excited to share more about the statewide longitudinal data system, the SLDS. But before we get rolling, I wanted to acknowledge that our Chief Education Officer, Lindsay Capps, would have been here, but was previously scheduled in to co-facilitate the government-to-government meeting today that's being hosted at the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Tribe of Indians. They're focusing in on a lot of things, Measure 98, chronic absenteeism, but specifically around the implementation of Senate Bill 13 that was passed through this committee last year to develop the Native American curriculum for Oregon students. So his time is well spent there. So again, I'm glad to be here with our SLDS project director, John Starr, to present the status and some key outcomes for the data system. This effort's been sustained through a collaboration with HEC Executive Director Ben Cannon and Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor and others. John will talk about the purpose and the use of the longitudinal data system, and I'd like to take just a couple of minutes to highlight a few key themes. The first is that we currently face a challenge in ensuring that data, and especially data over time, is readily available and visible to multiple users across the education system. And note that the data that we do have is not currently connected across systems or agencies. And I think Amy Cox referenced that earlier. And that makes it very challenging to understand how programs and early learning truly impact success in our K-12 system, and how policy and practice changes in our public schools impact success at the college level as well as workforce readiness. So the SLDS is an attempt to right this issue and make our data both more accessible and more integrated across the P20 to workforce continuum. Longitudinal data is a connective tissue and a necessary tool if we want to achieve the hope of a seamless system of education in Oregon. I know a seamless system across early learning, K-12, and higher ed is something that many legislators have sought and the governor is committed to achieving. This data system provides really an entirely new way to look at the data that we are already collecting across our various agencies. And this is critically important to our commitment around equity and seeking equitable outcomes for our students. The SLDS will allow us to see how students are transitioning across the system, what outcomes look like across different populations of students, and how specific interventions impact those outcomes. And perhaps, maybe most importantly, is to identify barriers for students as they transition across our education systems and into the workforce. So getting a new and different look at our data related to equity can also serve to strengthen our partnerships as we look for new opportunities to partner across agencies and across communities in Oregon to improve access and participation in high-quality programs that impact early learning and high school graduation. The last item I'll share before turning this over to Director Starr is that this system will also help us identify gaps in data that we may not currently be recognizing. As the system comes online at the end of December, we will also need to understand that there will be room for further growth and evolution of the system as it's used by stakeholders across the state. Both public and agency users will help us recognize and prioritize areas for further development. So with that, I am going to turn it over to John Starr to tell us quite a bit more about the SLDS.
Vice Chair Lithicum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Starr. I am the project director for the statewide longitudinal data system. Today, and I hope to be efficient in the presentation because I know there's some hard time lines already set. I want to cover the purpose of the system, what the data system will serve, and the needs and the users of that particular system across the continuum, our short-term project deliverables, as well as opportunities for future expansion and capability. Before we jump into that, I'd like to just frame sort of the historical timeline for the effort. The project was approved for execution during the 2016 legislative session. It was estimated as an 18-month effort, and we are in month 15 currently with our scheduled delivery of the first of the year. So we've been tracking to our estimates and our deliverables efficiently. So statewide longitudinal data system, it's intended to provide real-time automated access to student data. And when I say student data relative to longitudinally, this is de-identified and aggregated data, which is very, very important. So when we say access to student data, we're not referring to personally identifiable information. We are referring to de-identified and aggregated data sets. It does cover multiple years over multiple different learning settings. What that really means is we have the capability currently of having a longitudinal view of a student's chronology from kindergarten through to high school graduation into higher education, both two-year and four-year, and the workforce environment. So that gives us a pretty broad perspective to be able to look at a student's history over time. I should say aggregated students' visibility over time. The reason behind this is to provide a tool that allows decision makers, teachers, instructors, policymakers, a tool that can answer very specific needs to make informed decisions. That's the whole reason that this tool is there. It's not the decision maker. It's not intended to be the authoritative source. It's a tool. And that was the rationale behind it, and that's what we intend to deliver. The purpose, improve student learning. This is a tool that you can quickly create differentiation of student cohorts across multiple years. Cohorts can be defined based on the specific parameters of the researcher and or decision maker. It enhances research and analysis to evaluate and develop programs and practices that are currently in place. And when I say that, that can be used as a validation of a program. It can be used in order to look at opportunities to increase the efficiency and the output of programs. Clarify identity across to and the outcomes of programs across student populations and geographical regions. Our student body is mobile. 1 year does not equal the next year, and so on. This takes that information and can consolidate it and provide a history. It's intended to perform policy and resource allocation decisions relative to programs in need, as well as address educational inequities, reoccurring impediments to student learning. Short-term project deliverables. Like I stated before, link the data across those continuums. This would include, and this is a very high level, student demographics, degree status, course history. It provides real-time automated data access. The current tools that supply this system are extremely powerful and can manipulate the information as set by the researcher and or individual and provide that information and data back very, very quickly. Allow statistical analysis of student history over time. Again, allows analysis of student cohort. What does that history look like over time? Where do students go? Where do they end up? How are they, how does their educational history look over vast periods of time? We also provide privacy protection for that information that we do have. The system itself incorporates encryption both with data at rest and data in motion. Data at rest means it's information that's currently contained within the system but not being utilized. And then data in motion, where the data is actually being exercised to produce a result. Current data, K-12, we have academic year 2006-07 to present. Higher education, community colleges, and public universities, the same time period, 2006-07 academic year to present. And workforce system data from 2000 to present. So it's a significant band of information that we expect to tie for a longitudinal perspective. This is a visualization. Tools generally are not very usable if they can't be articulated or communicated. So part of the business intelligence portion of the system allows the user to basically pick and choose their visualization output If you want to put it in an example, it would be like Excel, only with a little more kick, like steroids. So it can do the standard pie charts, the columns, the 3D columns, scattergrams, pie charts, that sort of thing. It can also produce table information that the end user can manipulate and place within a presentation or an output medium to meet their needs and their particular audience. This is an example, and I truly wish I could go actual on this, but we're limited at this point. This was a smoke test test case that we did for chronic absenteeism. This is an interactive exercise that would allow the user or the individual that's experiencing the data to actually pick between school year 2014-2015 or 2015-2016. Again, the user sets those parameters. The institution look, whether it be district or school. The degree of chronic absenteeism based on percentage. And you can, this particular example, choose between 0, 25, 50, and 75%. So each row within this particular example is set by the user depending on the particular question that they're looking to have answered. You can also go to the next level of subgroup and look at either all students. You can look at specific grade levels and or race and ethnicity. So it's how do you want to slice the onion is set by the user. It also gives the results in tabular form at the lower left side of the visualization example. So if I had the opportunity to smoke test this, and it was extremely rewarding to look at school year 2014 and 2015, go into the greater than 75% chronic absenteeism, and rather than doing all students, went into the grade levels and looked at that percentage level across grades 1 through 8.
So I have a question from Senator Gelser.
Thank you. So in OLIS, there are screenshots instead of the interactive. Where do we go so that we can click on these buttons as you're describing?
Today, it's not available. This was, I had to make sure that what I was getting was good. So I smoke tested this offline. It's not currently available, but will be.
And that will be available to the general public?
This particular instance, and I'll get to that, answer that question in just a moment, this particular instance would not be available to the general public.
And
no good reason. It's not because, it's simply because we haven't thought about doing it yet.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I mean, the information is interesting, which is why we're hearing about it here, and I think a matter of public policy, if it's not an issue to make it public, I think if the public's information is going into the system about our communities, it would make sense that it be available to all of us as soon as practicable. Not just all of us here, but corporately, Oregonians to Oregonians.
Yes. Chairman Roble, Senator Gelser, totally agree, and that is the plan. It's in time to equal in the future rather than current and what we will offer at the start. Does that make sense? Sort of?
Not really.
Okay. Anyway, the point was that we had chronic absenteeism until the eighth grade. And that particular parameters that were set. So it gives an extremely powerful tool to identify a specific area And I forgot to mention, the map is connected to geocoding. So not only do you get the data, but you also understand where in the state it is. But it's a great communication tool to start dialogue with community, to try and understand why is it that you don't have a problem and until eighth grade and all of a sudden you have a big spike. So it's just an example of the capability that will be available shortly.
Mr. Chair.
One second first. Yes, Senator House.
Or it would be a great community tool if the community could just access this and utilize it, or even know about it if it were to be made public. And I second that emotion that this is should be one of those things that's just out there for people to play with and go on these interactive charts, and it really should be public. Is that true, though? This is maybe an aside about chronic absenteeism, because we wrestled with that here. We've seen that it does happen before eighth grade, or that it's. So, what are you saying?
In this particular example, again, in the year 2014-15, that's a parameter. Greater than 75%, and then dropping down and looking at only the grade level for that particular element, which represented a particular school.
It was true that it only happened, the first time it pointed itself out was in eighth grade.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Are there any other practical applications that you can think of where you can go to this and say, okay, here's something?
Chairman Roblin, Senator Haas, a perfect example. Let's pose the question, what STEM courses are being offered statewide? And we wanted to specifically understand what is the number of Hispanic females that are taking advantage of STEM courses across the state. This particular application could do a heat map of the state showing where that is occurring and where it is not, as well as the numbers of Hispanic female students that are taking advantage of that offering.
Chair Roblin and Senator Haas, if
yeah.
I can just add to that a little bit. I think that two things I wanted to clarify. One is that when this initially comes out, December 29th is the date where this will be rolled out and opened. Initially, there will be a series of reports available to the public that John will go over here in just a minute. Added to that, they want some time to have agency researchers and other partner researchers go through the data system to help find other errors that may come up as we're, for the first time, putting all these data points together from across a variety of agencies and tying them to student information across all those pieces. So we want to make sure that we're providing accurate information before that goes out to the public. So I think that's the delay between what will first be publicly available and what will be available to researchers at the agencies. So we need those folks to get in and move through the data and help us find pieces that may be problematic. And then second to Senator Haas's question, I think there are a number of things that we can look. So I think the next slide will actually show Sankey diagrams similar to what you saw OBC present a few years ago. You'll be able to select a cohort of students and say start them in seventh grade and look at different decisions that students made along the way. So students that selected to enter into CTE programs and what happened to them along their path through high school. Did they stay in high school? Did they graduate? Did they finish an entire CTE program? And then on into the workforce. And did they end up in the workforce and did they end up in the field that their CTE courses were in? You'll be able to take a look at state policy to implement full-day kindergarten and look at students who weren't involved in full-day kindergarten and look at their academic outcomes in third grade and those that were and look at their academic outcomes in third grade and be able to make some inferences around the impact of full-day kindergarten programming on our students. So I think there are a number of applications that will be available as they begin to work through the details of the system.
And Senator Gelser, just in case you wanted to finish up, and then we'll go to Senator Lithicum.
So in that you indicated you want to make sure everything's accurate before it's out there to the public, this is in the public domain. So I want to clarify, is it really true that Springfield has a high school in which 92% of their students have attended school for less than 90% of the time?
That is what the data showed.
And you know, Medford, 80% of the students attending less than 90% of the time. What's happening today? That seems pretty substantial. I recognize these are alternative high schools, but those are our most vulnerable kids. Mm-hmm. Is there an immediate swooping response from your office or from ODE to make sure that something is happening for these kids now that we know that only 8 out of 100 are going to school?
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser. So I think a couple of things. So this is data that is currently available through ODE. So there is an annual report. I believe it comes out every October. I need to check with ODE to be clear about that, of students who are not chronically absent. So that's the data report that comes in. So the data source and the authoritative data source is the Oregon Department of Education. That is already publicly available for single year review. What the power of this system is to look at those same data points over time. So yes, that data is available. Those schools are aware of that data. They help provide that data to the department. There are state reports that already report out on that. And we have been, as you talked about, we have been working on the chronic absenteeism issue in Oregon. We do have one of the highest rates of chronic absenteeism across the country. Last year, the legislature did choose to fully fund the chronic absenteeism statewide plan developed by ODE and the Chief Ed Office. And so we're in the process right now of developing systems to support our 20 districts that are most highly impacted by chronic absenteeism. So they'll be receiving direct support through coaching that is a system being developed by the Department of Ed. And then we'll have regional solutions to support districts throughout the state. And so there are efforts underway is what I'm trying to share.
Follow up?
Yes.
That's a little bit more disturbing because if it's not new information, I've heard about chronic absenteeism and I thought of a subset of students that we need to work on getting to school. But if I'm thinking of a school in which not just the vast majority, but almost all of the kids don't come to school almost all of the time, what's happening at that school on a day-to-day basis? Why is it still open, and what are we doing to fix that situation for those kids today? I mean, if I went down and walked into the school, would it just be like a ghost town with some teachers and no kids? What, I mean, 92% not there over 90% of the time.
The definition of chronic absenteeism is the kicker. It's they missed 10% of the days.
Yep.
So that means out of 180 days, they were there, they missed 18 days.
Oh, not that they, I misunderstood the data.
Yeah.
I thought the data was that they were absent at least 90% of the days.
No.
Okay, never mind. Thank you. That's a very important data point.
Did you have another?
Thank you, Senator.
Certainly. With regard to geocoding, this is really based on schools,
right?
Specifically, and can that drill down be based on district? So,
yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So, but each of these circles represents a physical school location.
Right.
That is correct.
And it can't go down to the student's address.
cannot,
no,
right?
No, it cannot.
Thank you. That's
and,
what I want to make
and
sure.
And then a follow-on question. The slide right in front of this shows a pretty typical standard normal distribution.
Yes, sir.
And when you drill into each of these schools specifically, do they all play out the same way? It's a standard normal. You know, it's something you can't avoid. Standard normal is standard normal.
Chairman Rowland.
Yes, please.
Senator Lithicum, that is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. I think it's important to state, and I apologize for not stating it earlier, the data contained within the longitudinal data system is provided to us from the authoritative sources. And in this particular case, K-12 is the Department of Education. Higher education is through HEC. Workforce is workforce. We do not generate the data. We link the data.
Right.
And I think, Senator Gelther, you hit a very important button. It's key to understand the data that is being presented because it's based on definitions that are provided with the data that's being manipulated. And our plan is to have those boundary conditions as part of the output of the system so that people don't misinterpret the information that they're looking at, because it can be misunderstood if you don't have that.
Thank you. Okay. And again, thank you to Senator Lindstrom. And to be clear, that's still concerning, but not
it is.
As concerning.
There are a few kids in the school.
Look under that chair.
In the interest of time, moving forward, these are some additional visualization that the system will be able to provide. A core chart that's a little different flavor of a Sankey diagram. It allows you to give greater definition to broader terms. Like I spoke to earlier, heat map example with as it goes across the state, and a Sankey example. And this shows the pathway over time for a particular specified cohort. Initial interactive reports, and this goes back to when will we give everybody everything? Our first offering is going to be program access mapping. It's specific around CTE programs in high schools with dual credit. Longitudinal pathways and outcomes for CTE programs and four-year majors. Longitudinal pathways and outcomes for post-secondary degree and occupation type. The last longitudinal pathways and outcomes for math time and choice points. Those will be the initial offering. We expect to expand that, going to the point about public access. It requires manipulation on our part. Excuse me, to be able to build those and based on timing and availability, this is what we could do within the 18-month period that we had to develop the system.
So in any one of those categories, I could go in and look at a particular school, a group of schools, a county, I mean other deals, and be able to get the information.
Yes.
That's specific to those areas. I wouldn't have to do the whole thing. It wouldn't be just one report to look at.
Correct.
I could, in any one of those areas, look at it from a local perspective if I wanted.
Correct. That's where this particular system is different than other systems being offered by other states. Most of the reports that go out are static reports. They're a snapshot. This allows the user to really vary the input and the parameters of the information being sought.
Okay.
One more question.
Yes, Senator.
One last question. As you're describing that data source in the 18-month, did this IT project get categorized into the stage gate process?
Chairman Roblin, yes, sir.
In which category? Stage gate 2, 3, what was it?
We went through all of the stage gates.
Okay.
We did stage gate 2, 3. We're currently in 4. Closeout will end stage gate 4, which will commence after the first of the year.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay.
Very quickly, along those lines, the goals of the project that we set early on in the effort, the system needed to be sustainable, scalable, and expandable. And it needed to maintain a knowledge equity within the team that was assigned to the project. So we have a total staff headcount right now of 4 people. And the expectation is that the effort is to be contained within the state in and of itself and not rely on outside resources. Further system development, and this is happening quite a bit faster than planned. Early learning is lagging a little on their data. They're building it as we speak. We're looking at doing some early consumption, most likely within the next 12 to 18 months. The SLDS team is working with them weekly to ensure alignment, as well as giving input to the format and content of the data. We're in discussions with Oregon Health Authority. Department of Corrections is interested. They would like to see if there is commonalities in profile over time that, I don't want to say intervention, but course correction could be taken, so they're quite interested. We're engaged with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and TSPC to help support the CAEP effort for teacher certification that was established to go live in 2025. We're looking at predictive models and modeling as a future tool expansion. Expanding our real-time automated access. This goes to more public accessibility. And then continuous improvement and stewardship of the data quality. Data quality is an issue. It is an improvement process that is iterative over time. As we run into issues, we give feedback to the authoritative source, and that information corrects the data, which gives better output. That is a continuous effort moving forward.
So in the back, in that, under the backbone of the system, is there a place where individually, not identifiable information, but you can track an individual person through the system? You don't know who that person is, but
Right. You
can track. So there is an identification number that's not attached to any of these other kinds of things. So have we got early childhood? I'm trying to figure out how do we get that identification number early enough to do that, because the schools, we've been doing that K-12, so I understand that. It made me nervous when we did it, but it still was done. So how are we getting that kind of thing done, and will that same trackable thing be then identified when they go into the K-12 public schools, same number so they can keep identifying it, or the same identifier? How do we do that? I just don't understand that, because it just makes me nervous.
Chairman Roland, great question. That effort is still in progress. We're working with Early Learning Division to work those specifics out at this point in time. But there is methodology to be able to link those two educational sectors together once that is established.
And the same going into college from the K-12 system. So we know it can't be the Social Security number, because that's been clearly identified as not a thing to do. So, but you are working on that.
I think that's my cue. within the system, one of the key and probably the most difficult area or difficult's the right word, is identity resolution and how different data sets are grouped over time. Right. And it's a very complex system, but the decision making in order to align specific data to specific individuals is still left up to a thinker. It's not a machine.
Okay.
Wow.
I don't have that.
Okay.
So I always find it intriguing. In high school, as a junior, they started a program in Washington State where they tracked a bunch of us. And I continue to get the surveys, and they continue to know if I don't turn mine in. So I know they know me, you know, because they'll send me other envelopes. But the data comes out as this conglomerate, so I can say, oh, all these people that graduated in 1966 are now, here's our distribution across different occupations and how many kids we had and all this other kind of stuff. And you can look for yourself in the months of stuff, but none personally identifiable. And we don't get any chance to go in and manipulate to try to ask questions. We just get what they send us. But it's been an interesting 50 years, 52 years of filling out forms. Are we going to do that for people in the future? Are we going to try to keep track of people outside of the K-12? And
okay. Workforce, possibly.
Okay.
I can't speak for them. Our intent is not to really reach out and follow you like that
system has. Okay.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it does give you insights into what things seem to be. If you made these choices early on, the choices that follow seem to be length of life, illness. I mean, there's a whole bunch of interesting data that they've.
Yes, sir. One last comment.
That's assuming people are telling the truth.
Right. No, it is. It's data in, data out. That's absolutely true.
One very last comment. Within the system, there is applied suppression. And that suppression is to control reverse engineering of the data that's presented to be able to get down and expose personally identifiable information. So that is a safeguard that is embedded within the system as well.
Okay. Those things are really important to me in the sense that we hear all these breaches with respect to knowledge, and all of a sudden we don't need everybody knowing a bunch of this information about individuals. Okay. Other questions? Or our group? I guess what I'm hearing from this group is that they're all looking forward to the opportunity and the time when it's really out there for the public to look at it and have a better understanding of what's going on in their schools. And clearly it's important to make sure that people understand what the data is. Senator Gelser was nice enough to prove that to us.
Ready to serve.
You always have been. I appreciate that. No, it is very difficult to wrap your head around things like that at times. And I've found myself more than a few times looking at the graph and thinking I knew what it talked about and then realizing that I had no idea what it was really talking about because I missed the first part of it. So having that conversation is really important. And having that upfront and on track with the stuff can help us. It still won't solve it for me all the time because I'm sure I would make that mistake of making an assumption about what I was just looking at that had nothing to do with really what I was looking at. So I thank you for that. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we look forward to that deadline coming in and actually going live. So that's exciting. I bet you do. With that, we'll close our informational hearing on the longitudinal data system, and we'll have a short explanation by our own Lisa Gesepfer about our education governance work group informational hearing, which we are meeting tomorrow. So.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, Senator Roblin convened the Education Governance Work Group last spring. The formation of the work group was announced during several Senate Education Committee meetings, and membership on the work group was open to any groups that wanted to participate. Representatives of 7 state agencies and 14 stakeholder groups joined the work group, as well as legislators from all 4 education-related committees. The work group's agendas and meeting notes are posted on OLIS as meeting materials for this meeting. To date, the group has held 4 meetings. At the first meeting, the proponents of Senate Bills 746, as well as 649 and SJR 37, spoke about their ideas for improving the state's education governance structure. As a reminder, Senate Bill 746, supported by the Oregon Education Association, puts in place an elected superintendent of public instruction, among other changes. Senate Bill 649 and SJR 37, sponsored by Senator Cruz, put in place an elected board of elected state board of education to select a superintendent. Also at this first meeting, Hannah Lai of Legislative Council spoke to the group about constitutional provisions affecting Oregon's governance structure. Among her findings were the following. Oregon's constitution allows for either an elected superintendent or for the governor to serve as superintendent. Oregon's constitution limits legislatively created offices to 4-year terms. Courts have already ruled that the state board cannot elect the superintendent of public instruction. Setting qualifications for an elected superintendent can be done via statutory change. Also at the first meeting, the LPRO analyst described research conducted by the Education Commission of the States relating to governance structures. Among the findings were the following. 12 to 13 states have an independently elected chief state school officer. 35 states include public preschool in their K-12 governance structures, although not necessarily early childcare licensing. 7 states have consolidated higher education and K-12 governance structures. At the workgroup's second meeting, Ms. Lai provided information on constitutional provisions relating to local control. Key takeaways from her presentation included the following. The state must establish minimum requirements for public schools in Oregon. Local districts can determine anything outside those minimum requirements. Discussion among workgroup members centered on federal involvement, the Oregon Department of Education's role model, the Oregon Department of Education's role as a compliance-driven rather than as a provider of technical assistance, and state mandates. The LPRO analyst provided responses to research questions posed at the first meeting. And you can find those in the meeting notes that are posted online. At the third meeting, the group heard a presentation from Dr. Conley of the University of Oregon Center for Educational Policy Research focused on characteristics of high-performing systems. Dr. Conley spoke about conceptual issues surrounding the choice of education governance systems, including key considerations, challenges, characteristics of successful models, Oregon's unique context, the goals of continuous systems improvement, and connections and disconnections between K-12 and higher education. His presentation included the following suggestions. Oregon's governance system should allow for maximum constituent input. Authority spheres should be clear and appropriate. Centralized government units should have high levels of expertise and provide technical support. Local government units should have technical support to execute their responsibilities. Governance structure should enable Oregon's education system to adapt more rapidly to changing circumstances, needs, and goals, and ESDs remain a key linchpin linking the state with school districts. The LPRO analyst provided additional responses to the group's research questions, and staff of DAS spoke about issues relating to shared governance. The group's most recent meeting included an exercise in discussing proposed mission statements for the state's education system, as well as the proposal of a third option, a Massachusetts-style unified governance structure proposed by Senator Roblin. The group has a meeting this coming Thursday at 2:30 p.m. At this Thursday's meeting, the group will consider the extent to which the 3 options under consideration meet 3 broad goals the group has been discussing: long-term stability, ability to attract skilled leadership, and equity and diversity among policymakers such as the State Board.
Very good. So we will try to keep you informed. People ask that when we set up the group, and we can't have a quorum there, so not everybody can be on the committee. And so we will continue to do updates and keep you apprised of the kinds of things that are happening and where we're going to go from here. And so tomorrow, I look forward to that. And as I have said all along in any of the groups that I have, if you haven't been involved and you want to, don't hesitate to show up. You may not understand everything at the time, but I have found personally that the more stakeholder ownership of the process, the better chance that it has to be successful in this institution. So want to keep having those conversations. And I appreciate all the people who have put their time and effort into being there and to making it work. Yes.
Thank you for doing this, Mr. Chair. And I think it's overdue. We have a system of deputies, and you know, we need to get into one plan. And I was just wondering what your goals were in terms of recommendation to the legislature or ballot measure. I understand there's some constitutional strings on some of those measures. So what are your what's a home run here for you?
I guess the home run is that as we keep working and we get information and we keep answering questions, that there will be a consensus of this large group that says we need to really focus in here. And in that, if that consensus starts to arrive, which it did when we were looking at, 314, the, what was the number? 215, which had to do with where we got with the education that we are now. If we can get to that place and start feeling comfortable with that, it may include constitutional amendment, because if we go away from the two options that are available in our Constitution, governor or elected superintendent, if we decide that that consensus believes that, then we're going to have to look at that. That means that I would have that come to the legislature to see if we can put it, if the legislative people can be convinced of that same thing. So it's going to be a multiple-tiered event. I don't anticipate personally that we're going to have that consensus develop before this legislative session, but as things come up, and it could, I mean,
it could.
We go back and forth. If it does, we will be bringing it to the whole body to look at it after that. And then how we implement that after that. We've had different conversations. Senator Cruz has been pretty clear that if we go with that elected board and they pick a superintendent, they need to have a lot of input into what it looks like after that instead of us designing.
Not elected board, appointed.
Right, appointed board.
Yes.
What it would look like, and how do we get those talented educational people to be in those positions to make some of those decisions as opposed to just us doing it. So we will keep you apprised as we move forward.
Thank you.
Any other questions or thoughts? Again, I want to thank Senator Gelser for working on the equity issues that we've been talking about in this session. We've had a number of presentations before with Teaching with a Purpose and some of those other kinds of things, and so I look forward to the work that you're going to be doing with that one. So I think I've talked about committee bills. We have three right now. We're looking at the possibility of the one with HEC that came up today. There's one with respect to fixing the kinds of things we didn't do with certification and making sure that we have a certification program that works. And then the third one that we're meeting tomorrow with, and Morgan, I think, came in, so thank you for being here, Morgan, has to do with open enrollment, which is coming up as a thing that we're going to have to deal with. We passed a bill a few years ago. We've been in that process. As you know, we've had lots of conversations about how many different ways there are. We'd like to consolidate some of that with respect to how kids transfer to and in from school. So we'll have that. We're having a conversation, and we'll keep you apprised of any of that kind of stuff that comes forward. Any other thoughts about things?
Just one more, somewhat education-related. I'd just point out that the Ducks are now ranked 23rd.
Oh, okay. That was very nice. Nice of you to point that out. Any other information that needs to come or suggestions that anybody has? And if you have an issue that's burning that you think would be a good educational committee bill, don't hesitate to get a hold of Lisa and I and let us know. But I appreciate that if you have any of those other ideas. So with that, I know it makes people feel uptight that we aren't going till 5, but
you know, what's interesting in this, because Senate Healthcare is the first committee every Monday during legislative days, and generally speaking,
Judiciary
is the last committee on Wednesday, and then I heard Judiciary had moved Tuesday, and I thought, oh, cool, and then you took the place.
So with that, we'll close the informational hearing about educational governance, and thank you, Lisa, for doing that. And with that, if there's no other comments to be made, we will adjourn the Senate Education Committee in the interim. Thank you. Education Committee in the interim. Thank you. Made, we will adjourn the Senate Education